I have to say that each time I get up here, I get kind of happy and I smile a lot. And I gotta tell you guys why, because it's kind of actually stupid. But the point, I think the thing that's funny about it to me is that, like, everybody comes on Sunday and they sit in pews and the purpose is to listen to someone talk for like 40 minutes. And sometimes I just feel like you guys are suckers for having come today and listened to me for 40 minutes. It's pretty funny. But I don't know why that's funny. I think the word that describes it is like verbal tyranny. I just sit up here and say kind of like what I want, and you guys listen. And if you really don't like it, you can like leave or throw like Bibles at me, which is not like, that's almost sacrilegious. So just leave if you have that option. Whew. You know, I'll tell you, it is a stressful thing doing this. It's not easy for me. So, I don't know. But last time I started, I don't know, half you guys I probably don't know. Some of you guys I do know. But if you were here for last time I was here when I was preaching, I started off with repetition being something that is important to you. Repeating things means it's important to you. And how I began that service was just praying that God was the one doing the work in the service, and it wasn't going to be, you know, a performance up front where it was like you guys are just sitting there listening to the person talk for 40 minutes and then going home. So that's how I'd like to begin again this week. Even though I know it's repetitive, prayer is, I do value it greatly and need it. So if you would just join me in prayer, that'd be great. Lord, just thank you for this opportunity, and thank you for everyone who's come today. And just in all, I'm a very grateful person right now that you've given this opportunity to be able to speak about you and some of your attributes. So, Lord, I just pray that today we would grasp those concepts and that they would become real things that we experience throughout our life as we leave from here. I just pray that they are lasting things. I know a lot of what we learn we forget, and that is the key to repetition. That is the purpose of it. And so, Lord, I just pray that today, that we do grasp the principles that are going to be talked about today, and that we do come to appreciate them and to be able to value you as well. So we just pray these things because of what Christ did for us. And in his name, amen. Well, I would like to begin with a story. Actually, you know what? I have something to do first. One second. I brought prayer cards, too. And they're in the back, and they're the first prayer cards I've ever done. So they're not very pretty at all. They're kind of ugly ones. But they are in the back if you want them, and they're on like a table back there. And so if you want them, you can have them. If not, that's fine. But they are there. So I'd like to introduce myself a little bit for those of you who don't know me. I am Luke Mikulovich. My parents were missionaries in New Guinea. I was their son, so I grew up there too. In a tribal location. I get so sick of saying this all the time, but I'm sure some of you guys haven't heard it. So, my parents are part of New Tribes, and the purpose was just to expand the gospel, to be able to present the entire Bible, hopefully, translated into their language so that they can read, understand it, grasp it, and hopefully respond to it. And so that's kind of the setting I grew up in. You know, early years was in a jungle location. Later on in life, I was mainly at a boarding school. And those were my high school years. I left New Guinea after graduation. New Guinea kicks you out 6 months after they force you to leave. And so I came back to the States, went to Bible school for 2 years through New Tribes, and then came out here for 2 years as kind of an intern type deal. And then went out to the Mission Institute where I'm at right now. So I'm just on my break. But that's my life story. Pretty interesting. But let me tell you another story. And this is the story about when I was in New Guinea at the boarding school. In New Guinea, there was the school we went to. It wasn't a large school at all. But there was a lot of times teachers that would come through as interns. And they'd come and teach us for a while. Well, one time this teacher came through. And just to protect his name and all that, I'll just call him Mean Teacher. And this intern, he comes from the U.S. He's a mean guy. I didn't like him. Was my Bible teacher. Imagine that. He's my Bible teacher. And he would start teaching, but he had some, like, anger issues. And he would sometimes get angry if there was talking in the back of the class. So he'd be up there talking and his back would be turned and he'd be writing with chalk on the board. All of a sudden he'd hear some talking and he'd just take that chalk, and he was a baseball player, and he'd just hurl it as hard as he could at us. And like, that's actually pretty terrible. See, I figured you guys wouldn't quite understand what that looks like. So just to give you the idea, I went to Walmart and bought some chalk. Because I figured at least a couple of you out there would think, oh, that's not that bad. It's just chalk, right? Wrong. I even drew a picture of myself. Because I had chalk thrown at me multiple times. You'll notice I have a halo on me. That's because I was a good student. I'm going to break it in half because usually he's already used some. And I'm going to try to hit this. Just so you see, I'm not even exaggerating about the throw. This is like seriously how he threw. Oh. Anyways, I missed. But imagine if I'd hit this, it would probably would have like creased my face. At least cut me or something. He never hit me. Came very close though. He'd also throw erasers at us, all sorts of things. Whatever was in his hand. Very angry, angry man. One time he was teaching my sister's class, and he was talking about how he'd once been so angry when he'd play baseball. He used to get so angry, so frustrated. If he struck out, he'd just take the bat and throw it on the ground and start yelling. And in the middle of the story, talking about how Christ had changed him, my sister and some hooligans in the back started talking, and he got mad and started chucking chalk at him and yelling at him and stuff. And that's very ironic, isn't it? I thought it was kind of humorous. One time I had a hard time keeping a straight face in school, and I was kind of chuckling in the back, and he got mad at me, and he was yelling at me, and I couldn't stop laughing. So he put me in the front of the classroom in a chair, but I still couldn't stop laughing. And he got so mad at me. He got right in my face. His eyes were doing the shaky thing. His face was just red, and he was yelling at me, just right in my face. And I couldn't keep a straight face worth nothing. I was really trying. And he got so mad, he picked up his Bible and just chucked it on the ground and walked out of the classroom. Just left the entire class. It was crazy. Anyways, that was the Bible teacher I had who I didn't respect much at all. You know, I just didn't care for the guy. And he was only an intern there, so he was only there for a year. But the point being, he was in a classroom. He was a teacher who was supposed to be an authority, and I was a student who was supposed to be learning from him. But the conclusion basically is that he didn't control the classroom. I mean, he couldn't control me. I couldn't help but laugh. And so he'd eventually just leave, or he'd yell and throw things. And the point was, he couldn't control the classroom, so he'd just get angry. But I was thinking about God a little bit. And like, you know, who's an authority? And there's many scriptures in the Bible that talk about kind of God's authority over us. And one of those stories, can you guys hear me all right? Yeah? One of those stories is just about King Nebuchadnezzar. And I'm not going to read it, go through it. We don't have enough time. But I'd like to parallel that story as God being the teacher, Nebuchadnezzar being the subject or the student, and the classroom just being the setting that they were in. King Nebuchadnezzar at the time, you know, the Babylonian king, was like the most powerful man in the world. And, you know, what he said went. You know, he was even like, in terms of power, he was more powerful than Caesar, because Caesar still had checks and balances through like the Senate and through the mob. Nebuchadnezzar, he was more a straight up king dictator. What he said went. If he wanted you dead, you were dead. There wasn't like, you know, a big crowd outside that, you know, he had to worry about. Are they gonna, you know, take over the city, build him a coliseum, you know, we'll kind of get their minds off things. Nebuchadnezzar, what he said went. And what he believed was that he was a god. He believed that he was divine. You know, he'd conquered basically the known world at the time. He'd defeated the superpower Syria to the north, to the west, Egypt, and kind of stepped on Israel on the way, you know, kind of just squashed them. And what happens is that he's in his ruling city of Babylon, and they believed in dreams at the time, and that dreams, you know, had interpretations and meanings and things. So he has a dream one night that he decides is evidently of some great value. It must be true. It's got to be important, because he basically tells his dream interpreters, the Chaldeans, that they need to interpret this dream for him. But so that he knows that the interpretation is correct, they have to tell him the dream too. So he dreamed it. He doesn't tell anyone the dream, but he says, you have to tell me the dream if you're going to interpret it, and then interpret it so I know the interpretation is correct. And if you don't do it, I'll kill you. And I'll use your house as like a, well, as kind of like a sewage plant. He says they'll kind of use it as a nasty way. And so there's a young Jew there, Daniel, who God decides to use. And Daniel prays, and I'm pretty sure we all know this story, but Daniel prays, God gives him the dream and the interpretation of the dream. And he goes before the king, he tells the king the story, and he's sure to say this is God of heaven who interprets it. And I just want to read Nebuchadnezzar's response to that from Daniel. Here's what it says. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor and ordered that an offering and incense be presented to him. The king said to Daniel, surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery. And so something that like very rarely ever happens in the human history happens. A king falls before a little 16-year-old boy and says that your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings. He's saying that he's even Lord over him. He's so amazed that this God could do it, that all his wise men couldn't do it, and he's just blown away. And I know that a lot of us have had those experiences throughout our life. We've had something happen, circumstances, and we're like, well, God is God. He created us, therefore he owns us, therefore he can do whatever he wants to us. And that's kind of the point that Nebuchadnezzar gets to in this passage. So, in conclusion, it's simply, God is the ruler of his classroom. He can control it how he wants. He created it. Us, on the other hand, we can't always do that, even though we feel like we might have some control. Speaking of authority, though, there's two types of authority that I can think of. The first type of authority is prescribed authority, and that's the authority that someone has because he has a title. So, for example, a policeman might come up and flash his little siren and his lights, and you see him in the rear of your mirror. You're driving along, and you're like, oh, lights, pull over. You pull over. A cop steps out. He walks up to your window. You roll it down. You look at him, and he says, here's a ticket for $500. And you take that and pay it to the state of Oregon. What if you were driving, and you looked in your rear view mirror, and there I was hanging out my window with a flashlight going like this. And you're thinking, oh my word, what the heck? So you pull over to probably try to beat me up or something. And I walk up to your window and I'm like, right on a notepad, you owe the state of Oregon $500. Would you pay it? Absolutely not. Because I don't hold a title of authority over anyone in that kind of a manner. And that's kind of the point, that God holds the title of authority as God. And he's the God of gods and the Lord of kings. And that's his title that no one can take unless they're more powerful than him. But the other kind of authority is ascribed authority. And that's the kind of authority that you might see in like in the military. Let's say like there's a group of men, they're all in battle. The man who has the prescribed authority at the time gets shot. He's the leader of the group. He has rank on the rest of them. He gets shot, and there's like a group of men, and they all have the same rank. Well, usually one person takes over, and it's usually the person who has modeled through their life and experience that they are an authority over the rest of them. Usually people will look up. They've already seen their life, and they've seen the decisions they've made, and they respect that. Therefore, they place authority in that person, even though he's the same rank. And that's what ascribed authority is. We all do it. I mean, we've all met people that we respect greatly. And basically what we've done is, in a money sense, we've taken our stock of authority and we placed it in that person. We go to that person for advice. We go to that person to listen to. Well, when I was looking at just the Bible as a whole, I think a lot of us view God in the sense of he's a prescribed authority in our life. And that's kind of mostly the realm that we look at him with. The Catholic Church highly emphasizes this sort of thinking, which is good. It's correct. It's absolutely correct. And that's that God is God. And they revere him greatly and fear him greatly. And that's a great thing. But I think that there's another issue too, which is ascribed authority. And that's the authority which I think that for the most part, the Jews didn't quite understand. See, in their past, as they looked even through scripture and the Pentateuch and stuff, they would see that God always showed his authority. He would win battles when they needed it. He took countries. They took Canaan if they needed it. The Egyptians were defeated just by water coming over them. He flooded the entire world. He's the one who kicked the humans out of the Garden of Eden. So basically, God did what he wanted when he wanted it. And as the Jews continued to think about that, they established in their own mind that God is the prescribed authority over the world. But what they didn't think about is whether he would ever be an ascribed authority. And I just think it's so interesting that when they got the promise that there was going to be a Messiah, that they couldn't hardly believe that Jesus was that Messiah, simply because they couldn't believe that he would actually be that personal with them, that he would actually come and want to earn his authority with them. And I think that's really interesting. I'm going to read from Matthew 8. You don't have to turn there if you don't want to. You can if you desire it. I'll be in Matthew 8, 5 through 13. And here's what it says. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. "Lord," he said, "my servant lies at home paralyzed and in terrible suffering." Jesus said to him, "I will go and heal him." The centurion replied, "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself, a man under authority, with soldiers under me, I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he was astonished and said to those following him, "I tell you the truth, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith." I'll skip down a bit to 13. Then Jesus said to the centurion, "Go, it will be done just as you believed it would." And his servant was healed that very hour. What really strikes me about this passage is one, that Jesus has already showed that he's the prescribed authority in the sense that he's about to go heal somebody. He's about to do something really miraculous. And I was going to try and learn a magic trick for you guys and like really impress and wow you guys. You guys would be like, "Oh, wow, that bends all of space and time and physics and stuff." But yeah, all I could think of was like the little ring one behind your head, you know? And that wouldn't be amazing. It'd be kind of a joke. So I was like, "Oh, never mind." But the point was that Jesus had already done many miracles prior to this to gain people's respect and authority. They were to see that this man, there's something unusual about this guy. He's doing things that no human should be able to do. So he's saying, "I am God." But then at the same time, when I read this passage, there's something that stands out to me. And it's pretty simple. But when you look at all the rest of Jesus' miracles, he usually did it on a very personal level. He usually touched somebody's eyes, you know, spit in the mud, rub it in his hands, and touch the person's eyes. Or with Lazarus, he travels all the way there to be able to heal him, to call him out of the tomb. He was always where he was going to do the healing. But then, in this passage, in verse 10, it says that Jesus was astonished at the faith of the centurion. See, the centurion comes all the way to him and says, "I've got someone who's sick, and he needs to be healed." Here's what Jesus says in verse 7. "I will go and heal him." He's saying, "I'm going to come with you, just like I've done with all the rest of them, and I'm going to heal him." But then the centurion replies, "I don't even deserve to have you under my roof." And he goes into a talk saying, "Hey, I've got authority. I tell people under me what to do." And he's basically saying, "You have authority." That's what astonishes Jesus. And what's really cool is that Jesus just says, "Go, and it will be done just as you believed it would." He was just about to travel with him to the place to go heal his son. He was willing to meet the person where he was at, but instead he's like, I'm amazed that you've given me that much authority to work with. And he does exactly what the guy says. And there's a principle there that is actually really cool. And it's very simplistic, but it's just that God meets you where you're at. He has all power, all authority, but he's only going to meet you to the faith that you give him, to the authority that you give him. And it's just amazing to see the lack of faith with everyone else. I mean, I skipped the section, but he just talks about how great his faith is, that he was able to believe him outside of space and time to heal somebody at a distance. And I just wonder so much in my own life how much authority I give the Lord myself. You know, so easy is it to look at Jesus and think, man, he was just a man, you know? It's hard to view him as God of the universe, to give him that kind of authority in your life to be able to say, hey, I'm going to meet you at this level of faith. And that kind of stood out to me because I'm not a person of faith, I wouldn't say. Another thing that I thought was just interesting when talking about authority was just kind of the Jews believing that you know, this all-powerful king, this guy who's going to rule over, take over the Roman Empire, was going to come and basically defeat the Roman Empire. And obviously not believing that, hey, an ascribed king was going to come, a king that was going to not take over the Roman Empire, because that's not a king. And what stood out to me a little bit about that was just simply that the people believed that if they gave authority, if they had an authoritative figure in their life, that person was going to take care of their physical needs. And it's so funny that we still have that kind of a belief system today, that we still think that you know, if God has authority and I'm trusting him, then therefore my circumstances are going to work out. And I know that's a hard thing to say in a troubled economy, that all things are going to work out for you if you give God authority, if you give the Lord authority in your life. But I think that's a misconception, because if you look at their lives and even the disciples' lives, that never happened. Even if you give them authority, your life might not get better. It might just get worse. And it's kind of depressing, isn't it? A little bit depressing? Not so encouraging? I think that's why it's so hard for me to be able to give authority to God, is because I have my own expectations of what is good for myself. And to be honest, if I give God authority in my life and it turns out to be not what I wanted, well, then I question whether I'm going to give him authority in my life. Because we've all gone through bad things in here. I'm sure we have. All of us have our own stories of bad things that have happened to us. And at those points of bad things happening to us, we question if God's an authority. And if God's an authority and this bad thing happened to me, then therefore God is not a good God. And even though we wouldn't say that in church or to our friends, I think that's a thought that's in most of us. How well can you trust God? How do you know he's a good God? Because in your experience, you've experienced some pretty bad things. And I think it's a point that can cause a lot of us to doubt. I know it does for me. I cycle a lot. I would assume that a lot of you guys cycle a lot through these things. James, you're not going to have water left. I have a lot of plans for my life. You know, I'm a young person, and I do struggle with that a lot. You know, what if I do fully give authority to God? What the heck is going to happen to me? You know? The disciples didn't have a good life. Paul didn't have a good life. Jesus didn't have a good life. So what's going to happen to me? So why is it even worth it if I don't even know what's going to happen to me? And it's an interesting thought. I remember in 1 John 4:18, it talks about perfect love casting out all fear. And I find myself in a lot of fear about where God's going to take me if I let him have control. But it says perfect love casts out fear. And so I find that the solution to authority and fear of authority in God is only found through love. And that's an interesting principle. I don't think we can define love. I think it's an abstract thought. I think we have characteristics of love in the Bible, but I don't think that I could necessarily give you a great definition of this is what love is besides Christ. That's the only thing I can tell you. On a relational level, experiencing Christ is love. So I'll leave it at that. But I would like to leave you guys with a story. I think I only have like 15 after. Is that correct? Good thinking. From Mark 5. And really what it is just a love story. Because when we're talking about authority, you have to trust that person to put authority in him. And then not only do you have to trust him, but you also have to believe that they have what's in your best interest in mind. And so I just thought that I'd try to encourage you guys at least a little bit from Mark 5 with a love story. Women, it's not that kind of love story. It's two men, actually. It's Jesus. So I have to give you a little bit of context to it. Jesus has been preaching to a group of people on the side of a lake. And he's been given a bunch of parables. If you look, you see a bunch of red all over your pages. And that's because Jesus is talking to a whole group of people prior to this. And that's where we pick up in verse 435. That day when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side," talking about the lake. Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There was also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him up and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to the disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" They were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." So we see some of his authority there. Chapter 5. They went across the lake to the region of, can't pronounce it. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had often been chained hand and foot. But he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Swear to God that you won't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." When Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." And he begged Jesus again and again not to send him out of the area. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, "Send us among the pigs, allow us to go into them." He gave them permission, and the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep banks into the lake where they drowned. I'm going to skip over to 18 now. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him, but said, "Go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you." So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and all the people were amazed. And you're wondering, how is that a love story? I think what's so amazing is that Jesus decided to leave a crowd of people that he was teaching to go to one person who was probably the worst of the worst to be demon-possessed by just, you know, it says 2,000 pigs. I don't know how many demons it takes to possess 2,000 pigs. But to go meet a person like that and to have mercy on him. You'll notice that Jesus in the beginning said, "Hey, let's go across to the other side." He had a purpose for going to the other side. He knew what he was about to go do. And then you notice all these little other boats are following him. They want to talk to Jesus. They want to see the miracles. They want to hear him. And all of a sudden, conveniently, a storm pops up, which is kind of interesting, you know? Was that brought about? I have no idea. But it probably got rid of those boats. He gets to the other side where there's a demon-possessed man who is probably some of the worst, if not an example of the worst man in the world. And that's the person that Jesus went all the way on the other side of the lake to go talk to. And that's pretty cool to think about. That is a love story. And I think it's passages like that that, I don't know, bring me back to realizing that love is true. It's things like that that I have to meditate on to believe that God is an authority and what he's going to do in my life is going to be good for me. Because it's not just enough to believe that he is the authority. James 2, even the demons believe that and shudder. We don't have to believe we can believe it's theistic. It doesn't matter. The ultimate goal, though, is your authority a good authority? And my conclusion is he is. I don't know what your conclusion is. I don't know where you're at, and I don't know what you've gone through. But that's my encouragement to you. So I think that's it. Let us pray. Lord, I am just so thankful that you are a good God, that you are in control, and that you do have my best interests in mind. And I know that I struggle with that a lot. I struggle with giving you authority in my life. And Lord, I just pray for this group of people as well. I don't know where they're heading. I don't know how much they believe that God is an authority, can have authority. But Lord, I pray that as a group here today, that we would be yielding to you, that we would be humble to you. Because Lord, I recognize that you're not coming down in this time period to basically make a fool out of us like you did Nebuchadnezzar, Lord. Basically just prove that you are God and you hold the authority. I just thank you that you give us the option to accept your authority, which is based in love. And I just pray that everyone here today would realize that, recognize that, and accept your love as a free gift. So we just thank you for your son, who's making this all possible. And we just pray these things because of what he did for us. And in his name, amen.